Call the meeting to order. We could have a moment of silence, please. Stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, please. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Just a short piece of housekeeping. If we could make sure that all cell phones and other electronics devices were turned off so they don't affect our PA system. And if we could have roll call.
Charlie Hopkins.
Here.
Dennis Olison.
Here.
Bonnie Onion.
Here.
Harry Robinson.
Here.
Clark Cotner.
Here.
Paul Greeno.
Here.
Ken Oppelger has requested to be excused tonight.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Next item is recognition and awards. And I've got a brown bag here, so that'll be something in it. Carol, would you come forward, please?
First of all, it may be fairly obvious, but I love my job. And it's been a privilege working for the city. Best boss I have ever had has been the city of Blaine. They let me pretty much run the visitor center however I felt like it, with very little interference. And they've been extremely generous with me, through thick and thin. So I especially want to thank the council and city administration for treating me so well. I really appreciate it, which is one of the reasons that I plan to stick around. So I will stay there until you're in a position to hire someone to replace me. So I'll be around for another year. So thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
Okay, the next item of business will be commission, committee, and board reports. Mr. Kuttner, Blaine Economic Development Advisory Committee.
We have no report, and we decided to hold our next meeting in conjunction with the consultant of the city's hire for business development. And that's it.
Okay. Bonnie, Blaine Chamber of Commerce.
No report.
RED Loan Committee.
No report, no applications.
No applications, okay. WTA Board, Paul.
The WTA held a public hearing last Thursday to discuss proposed fare changes. The idea is to streamline matters and issue a day pass and I believe a three-day pass or maybe a month pass and to get rid of a lot of the tokens and the this's and the that's that we've been using. There was little objection. A couple of people did ask that we reconsider, and their comments will be taken into account in the revised proposal presented next month.
Thank you, Paul. Charlie, anything on the Drayton Harbor Shellfish Advisory Committee?
No report.
Dennis, how about the Library Committee?
A couple of items. The new director for the county is Christine Perkins, and she was with Bellingham. And they have put a new phone system, and it's a centralized system that's computerized. And they talked a little bit about the situation in Ferndale. They're having a bond election on the 23rd. And that's about it.
Okay, how about the senior center liaison?
A couple of items. There's to be a rummage sale on April 6th from 8 to 3, and people that have items they'd like to contribute, it'll be Monday the 1st through Thursday the 4th from 9 to 3, they can drop them off. And the monies made will be used to support activities and services. And the other item is in May 5th, they have their annual springtime high tea. And if you're interested, the tickets are $15 per person.
What time of the day is that?
What time of the day?
1 to 3.
It's a Sunday.
And I am still trying to find out what's the difference between a high tea and a low tea.
You'll have to go to the Empress.
I think
Victoria
mostly ladies go to this, but the men serve.
Oh, wow.
Well, I was told that the high tea was, if the table was like a dining room table, and if it was a coffee table, you got low tea. You don't believe that?
No.
Mr. Jones, do we have anything from the Planning Commission?
Nothing on the Planning Commission, sir, and no report for the Park and Cemetery Board.
All righty. Chief is not here. Nothing on law and council. How about the Small Cities Caucus? Gary, do we have anything on that?
We met last Tuesday, and the primary business was going with John Michener took us through the new website that's being maintained at the Port of Bellingham that has a lot of the industrial properties throughout the county on it. You're able to go in and make various, there's a menu with various kinds of types of property and sizes. Also has some pretty good demographic material on each of the communities. So I think it's going to be very effective. And so we watched him do that for an hour, and
Terrific. Question from Bonnie.
Is the airport property one of the industrial parcels?
No, it's not. In fact, I think there's only one property in Blaine right now. The website is the property is populated by the commercial realtors. But there is a way to add properties to the website. And so we're going to add the airport property and perhaps some other, I talked to Pat about getting his property and some other properties in the city on the website. Mm-hmm. So we'll be doing that over the next little while.
Okay. Watkin Council of Governments has no report. And the North Watkin Fire update, Chief Hollinger.
Good evening, Council.
Good evening.
Monthly report for our district, and I'll just go over quickly. On the front page, you'll see that we do separate the North Watkin fire calls from the Fire District 4 calls because we operate Fire District 4 under contract. And so that's why you see those statistics broken out. Hopefully, in the not-too-long future, we'll get a merger on the ballot and we'll all be one district. So that's ultimately the goal. So you have some statistics and dollar loss. You can see that for the month of, there was no dollar loss for District 4 and about $246,000 for District 21 with a $522,000 save rate. On the next page, I've highlighted the two City of Blaine stations, 61 and 62. You can see that Blaine had 51 calls and Semiahmoo had 3 calls for the month. And then we have some more information about personnel issues, some signage issues, a little bit about District 4 and District 21 both had their annual audit, and we came out with no findings. Couple suggestions, but all of our finances, according to the state, are in order, or we feel they're in order too. So that came out real well. Follow that with some information about staffing for stations and overtime information, and then at the bottom of that page is a little bit about the fatality fire we had on Willie's Lake Road, which we're actually trying to improve on our PIO position because we found out when there's a possible trapped person in a fire, you get every law enforcement person in the county to come to your fire. And then everybody starts doing press releases. And we had some information that could have been more accurate released. So that was, we had a post-incident briefing with all the parties on that so we can kind of get our arms around how information is going to be disseminated and given out through the social media and through the papers. The following is a report on training and what our guys are doing, guys and gals are doing for training for this quarter. A whole page on that. And then as far as my division, the fire marshal, we're moving ahead with the school project for the summer. That's right on schedule. Semiahmoo Marina now has a fire engineer that they've hired to work on a new standpipe system for the marina, so we're making progress on that. They have promised us some preliminary information within 90 days. That's good information there. I believe we're almost through with the transfer of the station. Close?
That's what I understand.
Our board gave the chief permission to sign the papers on Thursday night, and so it's just a matter now of getting you two together to finish that. A little bit about some fire truck failures. Wiser Lake, our water leak, we got that bill reduced by $400. $400 more for us. And putting a well in Delta, our well at the Delta station is currently contaminated. And I've gotten 3 estimates. It would take about 4 hours to put a well in. It's going to take about 6 months to go through the permitting process to put that well in. So we have started the process, and we're going through permitting. And then we haven't finalized the signature on the contract yet for the clearing of the brush around Semiahmoo station, but I have a contract prepared for them. And we'll get that finished. So that's in a nutshell, about what's going on with the fire district this month, unless you have any questions of me.
Good, Chief.
Good, Chief. Thank you.
Next item is the city manager and staff reports.
Okay,
Mr. City Manager.
With Raven.
Okay. Well, Just a few things to report on this this week. First, I'll let you know that the we had our pre-construction meeting today for the Harvey Pipeline project that you awarded a couple of meetings ago, and the contractor feels that they're most likely going to be starting in the middle of next week. They're ironing out some final details. We will be sending out a letter, Public Works will, this week to notify property owners of the project. Let them know that the high-pressure water main will be available to them if they want to install the appropriate devices, as well as for people that are not currently customers, since they have but existing water main, they would qualify to become new customer. We also made some progress a week ago Friday with Puget Sound Energy on our service area agreement. That's been something that's been a top concern for us, and we made some really good headway with essentially establishing our watershed as part of our service area. So we have a lot of power infrastructure up there. Obviously, all of the city limits, including East Blaine and the 8th Street project, which has been a topic of concern, and we're working through some of the other details. The process would be, after we agree upon the terms, they would go to our respective attorneys for review, the actual document. Then it needs to be reviewed by the Utilities Commission, Utilities and Transportation Commission for the state. So our hope is that we will actually be getting those streetlights up this summer. Some good news on the Department of Commerce grant. We were notified last week that we did succeed in getting the full $500,000 grant amount, which is the maximum available to small cities. Now I'm working with JCI and Jeff on the rest of the financing package so we can pull together that project and actually get started on the final design. So if you recall, there was some pretty extensive improvements in the wastewater plant that would be revenue generating within the third year, and then the remainder of the improvements paying for themselves with energy savings over the 15-year period of the project. So very excited about getting that grant. Finally, we had a small outage last week on the Bell Road. We had a large tree limb knocked down one of the lines around 12:50. We responded within 7 minutes and had power back on within an hour. So very proud of our light crew for that. Thank you.
Question on the water main project, does that affect the school buses or anything like that with construction, you know? Schools should be notified.
Yes. Once we have the exact construction schedule, we will notify the school district as well as emergency services, so that's on my to-do list. One of the first things that the contractor plans on doing is actually widening out the area at the end of pipeline by the gate so that their trucks can turn around. So I think you'll actually notice an improvement for the school buses over the long term, and hopefully not too long of a inconvenience.
Thank you. Raven, when can we expect word on the rest of the grants? I mean, is that
the rest of the grants for the ESCO project?
Yeah.
Well, the rest of the money is probably going to be loan or a loan grant combination. We're working on probably three different sources right now, maybe four, depending. One of those would be a grant loan combination potentially for the wastewater component of the project. That would involve separating or getting two different financing, one for the wastewater component and one for everything else. I've been communicating with JCI on a weekly basis. We're going around reviewing different interest rates, different packages. If you have any suggestions, we're certainly open to them, but we're trying to finance, if you recall, about $2.1 million. That would be the remainder that we're trying to finance. The other angle that we're pursuing is how much we might qualify for in BPA rebates. As you know, we do rebates for residential and business businesses here in Blaine as a part of our conservation program. Well, our own project qualifies for that same type of rebate if we want to provide that to ourselves. We're limited, however, by the amount that BPA gives to us each year. And so once we determine how much we're eligible for, my intention is to contact some of the other power utilities around the state and see if we might be able to do some kind of reciprocal arrangement to help us fund the project. And that would be ideal because that wouldn't have any interest. So our hope is that we can bring something to you. Our initial hope was to bring something to you by the end of April, hoping that we would have something applied for by the end of this week. I don't know that that's going to be the case, but I would hope to bring you back something in May.
Okay. Clark, you had a question?
Yeah. Where are they going to pick up the
name? 8th Street?
Yes.
While I'm waiting for the contractor to get back to me on some of the structural elements of the job, what I've told him is I don't want you coming back until you can finish it all. So as soon as I have that date, I will let you know.
All the curbs and all that stuff, everything's done except the paving, correct?
All the curbs are done. We got pavement markings. We have a little bit of landscaping remaining. And the big banner arch is actually the thing that's taking the longest. It's a big structural steel arch that is going to go between the two poles at the very end of the street to hold up future banners. It's 57 feet wide, I believe, and it has just this week been, the galvanizing has been finished and it's being brought to their shop for painting, so I think we're getting close. The other thing that we're waiting on is the benches, the garbage cans, bike racks, all those types of street furniture will also be going in. So again, I don't want them coming just doing paving and coming and going away. I want them come in, get her done, we'll be done, and we'll have plenty of notice to the businesses and plenty of notice to you as well.
Thank you.
Raven, we had a deadline on the Martin property. Can you refresh my memory as to what date that was?
March 21st.
March 21st.
And our plan is to update you in an executive session today.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Raven? City Manager?
Okay. Next is public safety. I see that Mike just walked in. Mike, do you have a report?
No, sir. One quick note just to let you know on in regards to staffing, we have taken on our first of the hires relative to replacement of the officers who we lost recently. And he's begun his FTO. It's actually one of our reserve officers who did very well in the testing process, a young man by the name of Timothy Richardson. He'll be in field training until he goes off to academy. And so he should be on the road and independent by year's end. And we have another probationary interim officer will be beginning his process tomorrow. So, okay. Process continues. Okay. I'll keep you posted.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Questions? City Manager?
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Next, we're going to hear from Michael Jones, who has several issues, the first of which I have to say is pretty exciting concept that Michael has been working on, and it's one of those things just one of a number of things that I feel real good about in terms of attracting new businesses to the community. So let's turn it over to Michael and let him tell you about it.
So the first item here is the Gateway Wetland Mitigation Program that we hope to develop, and we wanted to give you an update on that and kind of get a little bit of a nod of approval as we go forward and spend some money on this. You'll obviously get a chance to approve the whole concept if it moves forward, but we did want to let you know up front what we're looking at. There's basically three different ways that you can mitigate. Well, really, there's four. The first one is you have an impact on a property, a wetland, say you're filling it, and you go out on your own, you figure out how you're going to create a wetland somewhere else or enhance a wetland somewhere else or protect by buying a large wetland and putting it into a sort of a preservation status for forever. And you can do that all independently. You can do that on your own. Developers do that all the time. Other things you've heard about, something like a wetland bank, is a very complicated, very large project that involves a great deal of time and money to set up, but it makes it possible for someone to just go out and buy a credit, like you'd buy stocks or bonds, and then you're done. The next kind of on that tier, that structure, next one down, is something that's called an in-lieu fee program, which is what I was hoping that we could do. An in-lieu fee program is where you basically, instead of doing mitigation, you pay, it's typically the city or the county, into a fund where they will then go and do mitigation on a larger scale once they've amassed enough funds. I hoped that we could do that, but that's not what I'm going to tell you about tonight, because that's a pretty expensive and time-consuming process to get approved. We've been kind of in a holding pattern for a while, hoping to sell some more of the airport property to initiate that program, just like we've been trying to put together the regional stormwater pond out in that area. But it's that cart and horse kind of thing. You need to have some money before you can make some money. And so I've decided let's move beyond that and let's look at another kind of program, which they call the local only option, which essentially means that the program would satisfy, I lost my picture, but I'll put it back up in a second. The program would satisfy the local jurisdiction's mitigation and critical areas ordinance, and it would basically satisfy your permit requirements at the local level. If you still need a federal or a state permit, you could potentially use that program to satisfy their requirements, but it's not designed to automatically satisfy their requirements. That would be one of those more expensive programs. It could cost $500,000 to put together an in-lieu fee program, or at least $200,000 or $300,000, and we're not able to do that at this point. It doesn't make sense for us. So the local-only program that we're proposing would be on the airport property, on the approximately 7 acres of wetlands that have already been delineated there. And what we would do is put together a program that would allow developers or property owners in the Cane Creek watershed, so in that same small watershed, to fill lower quality wetlands, Category 3 and Category 4 wetlands, which are basically wet fields or shrubby wet field areas, and satisfy the city's requirements for critical areas work by enhancing property on the wetland. So I'll explain a little bit more of that in a second. So our goal here, as Gary mentioned, is essentially it's an economic development program, because we want to try and speed up and simplify the process for people so that if they're going to be filling a wetland anyway as part of their development proposal, let's figure out a way to make it have A, the greatest benefit, and B, be relatively easy and simple. This is really, really effective if the wetland is what's called non-jurisdictional, meaning the core doesn't have jurisdiction over it because it's a small isolated wetland. When that's the case, the city is really the only regulatory authority. And so it's very efficient in those circumstances. When something is core jurisdictional, it goes through the state and the core process, and it's another step in the process. So what we would do is we would go out and we'd hire a wetland consultant, and they would develop a mitigation enhancement plan for the city's wetland property. So we would use the existing protocols out there, which is a watershed-based approach, to look at how can we create the greatest benefit from this property ecologically, and basically draw up that plan, right down to the planting plan of what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. We'd also, at the same time, work with an attorney to develop easement templates to make it very easy to essentially hand someone a document and say, fill in the blanks, name, address, and personal information, and how many square feet you need, and then we'll be able to lease you property. So we'll make it, not lease, excuse me, we'll be able to sell you an easement over a piece of property. So we'll make it simple for them to get the easement. And then what their responsibility will be, in addition to paying for the easement, is to implement the mitigation plan as it fits on their lease area. So you wouldn't have someone come in and mitigate the entire 7 acres. You'd have someone come in and mitigate 40,000 square feet and then maybe 180,000 square feet as they needed it for the different projects they were doing. And eventually the whole thing will become a fully mitigated wetland, all enhanced, which is good ecologically. We'd run out of area at a certain point. We wouldn't be able to sell anymore. But we would have facilitated and helped facilitate small development projects in our manufacturing and commercial area. And the proposal that I talked to Gary about would be the idea, first of all, it has to be in the Cane Creek watershed according to our critical areas ordinance, but it would also be for manufacturing and commercial properties. This would be strictly for things that are essentially job generators, so it would help develop properties around the airport site, around the gateway property. You don't need to take any action at this point, as I mentioned. We just wanted to get a sense from you if you thought this was a good plan. There is about $10,000 left in the airport budget this year, the gateway budget, for professional services, so we think we can work within that, at least for now, and hopefully not go much beyond that at all. And what we would do is we'd get the wetland scientist on board and also get someone writing up those templates. The cost of the project in total really is, we haven't determined that. We need to do research to find that out. But like I said, we do think we're within the budget. Ultimately, it'll actually probably be a revenue generator because you can't gift the public property for that use to someone for their financial gain. So you have to charge them for the easement. And, of course, we would want to recover the costs of the wetland planning and other things that were done. So we would probably also be working with an appraiser towards the end of the process to determine what's an appropriate value for that lease area on a square foot basis so that we can make sure that we are meeting all the requirements for being good trust of the public property, but also to make it not too expensive, because obviously we want this to be not only relatively quickly, but quick, but to be not very costly either. So I probably bounced around in my explanation there because I stopped looking at my notes when I stood up. But do you have any questions on that? And Raven has some, she has a handout that she's, I've asked her to pass around to you, which basically is the notes on this. So you'll be able to take something with you.
Michael, how many acres were you talking about that would be mitigated as a result?
Well, we have 7 acres, 7.1 acres on the wetland, on the airport property. We've talked about possibly doing a little bit of fill on that ourselves in order to square up one of the parcels and make it a little bit more marketable. But let's assume we're not going to do that. Let's just say we have 7 acres. Because of the ratios that apply with enhancing an existing wetland, we have 2-to-1 and 3-to-1 ratios that apply to that property. So you'd basically either cut it in half to about 3.5 acres of fill, or even lower to about 2 1/3 acres of fill that could be mitigated on the airport site. So it, best case scenario, it's 3.5. Lower case scenario, it's more like 2 1/3 acres.
But if someone else that has property that wants to use that mitigation, what equivalent would they be able to use? Is that the ratio you're talking
about?
Yeah,
I think that's the number that I gave you. If some, let's say one person wanted to buy the entire easement, all 7 acres of the city's easement, if they had a Category 4 wetland, they would likely be able to fill 3.5 acres. If they had a Category 4 wetland, or if they had a Category 3 wetland, they would likely be able to fill about 2.35 acres. But the thing is, it's really not very, it's not going to be very effective for that large project, because that large project needs an individual, it's called an individual permit, from the Army Corps of Engineers. And it's a large wetland fill. 2 or 3 acres is considered a pretty large wetland fill. And so that project is not likely to use our program. It's likely to use independent mitigation, go through another program, maybe go through a bank. This is really going to be much, you're much more likely to see somebody who wants to fill 15,000 square feet come in and buy a chunk, and buy a lease, an easement for a chunk. So you'll overall, it's still about 3.5 to down around 2.3, but it's going to be in smaller wetlands, I think.
Would that have to be on the, quote, airport property area?
Or the mitigation would have to. The fill?
Or the person that wants to use that mitigation, could they be outside of the airport area?
The person who wants to fill, where would they fill?
Yeah.
Yeah, they would fill outside the airport property on other properties that are in the city limits and are in the Cane Creek watershed. So could not on the airport property, but in the surrounding area.
Could we at some point get a diagram that shows the water?
Yeah, we will definitely do that. And for the most part, it's things north of Pipeline Road. I mean, that's rough because the Cane Creek watershed goes a little bit south, but it doesn't go that far south because there's another little tiny watershed that drains out into Drayton Harbor down by Bayview, just up the street from Charlie's house. So it's basically from about Pipeline north.
And how far north?
How far north? All the way to the top of the hill by Lincoln Park. Tell you there's the watershed break going down to Canada. Yeah. Any other questions on that?
Michael, how much property is outside of the airport land and how much property is inside the airport land approximately? That would fall under this?
It's all inside.
How much is in the watershed that could be?
Yeah. So, is it all just airport land or is there other land outside of the airport that would fall under this?
I'm confused. That could be mitigated on?
Yeah.
Well, we only own the airport land, so we haven't considered mitigating on anyone else's property. So there's 7 acres inside the airport boundaries. And then...
So this would only apply to airport land?
As a mitigation receiving site, yes. But as a fill area, no. You can, anywhere in the watershed. In fact, it's specifically designed for properties that are not on the airport, that are not city properties.
We don't need it.
We don't need it.
We don't have any wetlands on the airport.
Except for this one.
Except for this 7 acres.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
So,
any other questions? Well, anybody want to comment about how they feel about this, if they want the people to proceed, or is it a good idea, or how do you feel about it?
We need to look at it.
You want to look at it before you comment on this?
Well, I say, I mean, we need to go ahead.
Go ahead?
Yeah.
Okay, Bonnie has a question.
So this program would involve a developer purchasing an easement for the size they need. Would this involve any changes to the city's wetland physically?
Yes. It would be enhanced according to the plan that we develop with our wetland expert. Would basically, typically that would mean planting and mulching to try and get rid of the reed canary grass. And eventually that wetland would turn into either a forested wetland, which would be many years from now, or into more of a shrub complex. So it would be bushes and things. Instead of right now, it's basically a big reed canary grass field, which is not a very good quality wetland. It's not providing much ecological benefit.
Mm-hmm. But that would not be a good spot for the stormwater.
Well, it would be a good spot for the stormwater if it weren't a wetland. But since it's a wetland, if you were to dig a stormwater pond there, you would need to mitigate for destroying that wetland and turning it into a stormwater pond. We may be able to put some stormwater into it, but that has yet to be determined. Like, you may be able to feed it with some stormwater, but that has yet to be determined. It seems like a really good idea on the surface, but if you flood a wetland, you often kind of destroy it or dramatically change the hydrology. That's the nature of flooding something, so that's not something you can always do.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I understand it, what you're asking for tonight of us is approval in concept.
Yes, sir, in concept, or at least to make sure no one's saying, wait a minute, no way.
Okay, and what you would do would be sometime down the road come back to us with something more specific, including maps and pictures and all that sort of
It will stuff. Be maps and pictures, and it'll actually have things in it like an actual program of potential fees and some of the more detailed information.
So I'm comfortable with going that far tonight, and I think that that may answer Charlie's questions as well, as to how much detail we need to address the en passant at this point.
we'll bring back kind of an interim step there, showing you the potential contribution area, the exact site, talk a little bit about ratios before we go further and start hiring folks to spend money.
So you will not hire a wetland specialist?
No, we'll come back in a month or so and tell you a little bit more about the concept, and then we'll before we go into contract with anyone.
I think it's a go for me. Anybody else?
I have one more question.
One more question?
Is that wetland on city property, is that unbuildable?
There's no such thing.
Yeah, we went through this a little earlier.
If you throw enough money at something, you can do anything. The reality is, it's not unbuildable, but you have to really, really, really want to build on it, because you're going to have to go. If you fill that wetland, you'll have to go somewhere else and either enhance a wetland at a 2 or 3 to 1 ratio on a square foot basis, or you'll have to go and create a wetland on a 2 to 1 ratio somewhere else. And so, I think what you're getting at, though, you bring up a good point, which is we're making a decision, not tonight, but eventually, if you approve this, we're making a decision to not use that property for anything other than ecological benefits.
And is there more economic benefit to the city going that route than spending upfront money instead on filling it in and mitigating ourselves so that we can sell it?
I think
I'm
so,
sure
yes.
I'm sure you've looked at the whole picture. But
well, we haven't looked at all the economics, and we didn't do like a cost-benefit analysis. This is very early. But I think so, yes, and here's the reason why. There's a lot of manufacturing and commercial property in Blaine that is wet and has wetlands. There's a whole bunch of that already. Mm-hmm. And that has routinely been a challenge and a stumbling block for people who want to move forward with projects. Mm-hmm. So it would be a benefit to the city from a pocketbook perspective on our budget if we were to convert some of this property to dry land and sell it. We have to sell it. Mm-hmm. It costs money to convert it to dry land, so we'd need upfront money, and then we'd have to sell it to realize that benefit. What we would have done then is made some money for the city on this one thing. If we make this property available through a program that can help others develop their property, we've now freed up dozens of potential sites for development rather than one. And that's why I think this is the better option. We're here to provide services, and this is just another service. You will have to make the decision. Do we make it easy for people to free up their land for development, or do we free up this piece for one project? Okay. That's really what it comes down to.
What category wetland is this property?
They are category 3.
Okay. Well, does anyone have any objections to Michael going ahead? Michael, I think you got a green light.
Great. We'll come back with a little more information soon to lay out some of the areas and give you that kind of info, and then we'll move ahead with some more details. So I have two other quick reports since I'm already standing here. The first is the Council Chamber's acoustics update. We are going to order curtains tomorrow. Got all of that laid out. And there's my notes over there. And there are a few steps in that process. The fabric needs to be delivered. It needs to be fire treated. They need to make those curtains. They need to be delivered here and then installed. So it's not going to take a week. It's going to take a little bit longer than that. We're hoping it's still within the 3 to 4 week delivery time. Yes. That's what they're made for. Yep. We discussed this with you earlier that we had funding for that available probably through the REIT funds, and Jeff is going to bring forward a budget amendment to allow us to spend the money on acoustic improvements. For your next meeting, you'll have a chance to approve that. So we're going forward based on the fact that you've told us to do it, and the funds are available, but it won't be until the next meeting that we actually adjust the budget. We're not going to do anything with ceiling tiles yet. We're going to get those curtains up, make sure that we don't, to see if we need to do anything more, spend any more money, but that would be the next step if we need to. And then the last thing I have here is a very brief update on the city's CSA program, which is the farm share program. We have 8 employees that are participating in that. All of them have decided to take advantage of the payroll deduction option, which is great. I know that the school district is moving forward with their effort, and Let's Move Lane has sort of stimulated interest in a couple of other developers, a couple of other business owners to do something similar. So it looks like there are a few others out there as well. So the city getting involved looks like it really has stimulated some action. And I do have a couple of the packets here in case any of you meant to sign up when you got the information with your paychecks but didn't have the paperwork. So the deadline was actually this morning, but I talked to Christy and I said, come on, it's the council. And she said, well, I'll take it tomorrow if anybody wants to sign up tonight. So
is everyone clear about what he's talking about?
Yep.
Okay.
Everybody understand?
It's just free food, is that right?
It seems like free food.
In fact, you could be one of the farmers.
Yeah. You could have a tomato CSA.
That's right.
But basically, it's a basket, or it's a box full of fresh produce and local farm goods delivered weekly on a contract basis from the local farms. Great. Thank you.
Michael? Okay. Yep, Debbie? Sherry?
Thank you. I passed out to the council some information from Carl Turner regarding an update on the city manager search. And at this point, she's received 20 applications, but she does expect the majority of the applications to come in before the close on April 5th. That's a soft close. As you recall, this is open and still filled. But those who have responded by April 5th will be the first ones that the council will review. And so the next step is on the 8th of April, she will provide the council with the packets, and so the council can review. And then on April 15th, which is an off Monday, the council agreed to meet in executive session to discuss the qualifications of the applicants. What I need from the council tonight is a time so that we can notice that and also give part of the information. Does council want to meet during the day, or would they prefer an evening meeting? Tara believes it'll take about 2 hours.
Charlie, how about you? You agree with evenings are better.
Can we do it like 5:30, something like that?
Evenings are better for you.
Yeah.
I think we've got to look at an evening meeting.
Okay.
And I would suggest 5:30 or 6 o'clock.
5:30.
Okay, I will let you know. 5:30.
On the 11th?
No,
I mean on the 15th.
On April
15th.
Yeah. Just pay your taxes. Does that work for everybody? No objections. We'll go with 5:30.
Okay.
And you'll...
Pat, can you turn that thing back a little bit? Because when you flattened that out, it comes straight through when it was turned.
Yeah.
But when you turned it flat, it turned, not those, it's up above. When you turned it flat, it keeps it from deflecting it. No.
I think it only affects that one. Oh,
that's,
yeah.
Just, it was left open a little bit.
Got a bunch of vampires there.
That's better, thank you.
Okay.
Do we want to set a time for the Friday meeting on the 26th? As well?
Where are your sunglasses,
Guy? Well, it says to be determined. So.
That's what the other one said, too.
It's
so we can set them both at
5:30.
You're correct that the next executive session, to narrow it all down, would be on the 26th.
And we're suggesting that we have an evening meeting as well.
Yes. Can we do that at 5:30 as well?
Okay, we'll set that as 5:30 also.
Convey that to Karen that we want to meet in the evening, and we would prefer to start at 5:30.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll let her know. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
I can't see anything.
Last item is city manager. I just want to report that... We had a telephone conference with Jim Hebert about his the project that we're retaining him to do on an economic development project. I think that we kind of put together some various scheduling types of things that we talked about. I've put together a committee, project committee. It will be comprised of Todd Snodgrass from the Port of Bellingham, Michael from the Community Development Office, Clark as part of the ED Economic Development Program, and possibly Mike Kent. I don't know how that's going.
He said okay if it's correct.
Pat Rooney is a citizen. Dennis would like to be on the committee as kind of a citizen as well. Have I missed anybody?
I don't think so.
Yeah, that's kind of the group we're putting together. Mr. Hebert will, we're going to set a date based upon I need to get his schedule, and then working with this committee, put together a meeting with him where he can discuss kind of the scope of the work that that he's proposing to do, and to have a discussion and gather information from the committee about the kinds of issues that they would like him to look at, and just to kind of become a sounding board for some of the work that he will be doing. The committee will, there's not going to be like a weekly meeting with them. We'll probably have internally, Michael and I will talk with him on a weekly basis to see how things are coming. But in terms of him meeting directly with this committee, we're probably only talking two meetings, three at the most. But I'm thinking early meeting, and then when he has his work, kind of a preliminary final report to meet with the group, present that, those would be the two primary meetings. But in the meantime, we as internally, we can meet with the committee and talk about some of the things that he's doing at the Essen. Feedback that he needs from us, he can let me know, and I'll work in facilitating the group. So he's already, you know, he's already thinking, he's doing research already, he's got some ideas that he's kind of kicking around and checking some other areas in the country that are along the Canadian border. And, so he's, you know, he's pretty well into the thought processes about how, you know, what might work here. He's also turning loose some of his research people to talk to businesses around the country to, you know, get their sense as to how they would feel about coming to this area. We're talking fairly high-level corporate people. These aren't local businesses. They're national businesses in certain fields that he's identified. So it's, you know, my experience with this type of thing is that his approach to this is very different than you typically find in, you know, in an effort that a community like ours would move forward with. He's approaching this as though you know, he's working for one of his private sector clients that has property and wants to do something with it. And that's how, that's his approach. So I think it's going to be interesting, and hopefully it'll be productive.
Gary, should we be having somebody from the Blaine Chamber of Commerce in there? That makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they would like to volunteer somebody. It would seem to me that would be
Is Hebert also going to be looking at downtown properties as well? So this doesn't involve downtown at all, just manufacturing?
Just the industrial properties, manufacturing.
Does that include commercial as well as manufacturing?
It's primarily, if to the extent that there's commercial property in the zone across the highway where primary area for manufacturing, industrial properties, then I'm sure it would be looked at.
So we're not looking...
Some of the things he's looking at aren't, quote, industrial or manufacturing. They're...
assembly or...
You know, there are other kinds of businesses, like the committee mentioned a medical facility. Mm-hmm. He's looking at that.
So he's going to be looking mostly at job creation, not so much sales tax generation.
Well, he's looking at job creation, and he's also looking at tax base. So whether it's sales tax, property tax, but he's not looking at restaurants and gift shops and.
Okay.
Gary, could I ask you a couple of questions? I believe that the federal government has passed the act that would allow states to collect a tax on the internet.
That's happened quite a while ago. Well, our biggest sales tax generator in Blaine is Amazon.
But we now have, I understand Washington State will be given the authority to collect tax. I was wondering if we shouldn't be writing to our state representatives to encourage them to move in that direction now that the federal government has approved it.
Sales tax,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just been passed, but it now gives the state of Washington the right to say that in all internet sales involving Washington, you have to collect the sales tax.
Yeah, we can do that. Washington was one of a number of states in the country who modified their sales tax collection process in order so that internet sales could be collected within the state. The argument that the internet companies has made for years is that it's just too complicated. You know, how in the heck do they know you know, how to pay all these different communities. And so Washington and other states came together and put together a sales tax collection program that was all the same process, so that the internet companies could no longer argue that there was all of this different ways of distributing taxes. The streamlined sales tax communities tried to work together to solve that problem, and not all of the states have done that, but it was the effort that helped federal legislation get approved. So, I mean, Washington has been at the forefront of that. And they have changed the distribution of sales tax from a point of sale basis to a point of delivery. And that's why Amazon has become our biggest sales tax generator, is because when their products are delivered in Blaine, with all of our Canadian friends who have their mailboxes here, we get the sales tax because it's delivered here. It used to be wherever it was sold. But now it's point of delivery. So in many respects, Washington has been way ahead of this. And I'm not sure if there's anything that the state legislature needs to do, but we can check it out and see.
Okay. So it'd be helpful if we were able to collect tax on every item that was sold.
besides Amazon.
I can't imagine they would be dumb enough not to accept the sales tax given the budget. Who knows?
It's hard to police, though.
Okay. We've got the calendars, Gary. I guess that's...
Sherry, anything on there we need to call out?
I just updated on the calendar the two executive sessions that will be at 5:30. Everything else is pretty much from last time also. There's been no changes.
Okay.
Okay, that does it for us, Mayor.
Thank you. Written communications, Sherry.
We received a letter, Mayor Robinson received a letter March 12th from Toshishi Bijishore Shiro. I think I got that right. This is regarding the music festival that was in Japan. And I do have a letter to read the sign.
Yep.
Looks like What was that?
The letter that you wrote to Toshishi Bijishore.
Oh, okay. All right, gotcha.
We have an email dated March 13th from Tom Williams regarding the Tribal Issues Conference, and an email that I just provided to the council today that was dated March 23rd from Tony Dope regarding petition for the Amtrak Cascade Stream.
Okay, thank you. Next item is the consent agenda. Approval of bills in the amount of $226,012.74 and approval of the March 11, 2013 council meeting minutes.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Next item is the council action items. The first is Ordinance 13-2829, the Muirfield Preliminary Plat and Planned Unit Development. Michael, I assume that's you, or is
actually,
it
it's going to be Alex tonight on that.
Okay.
Good evening, Council. The plat of Muirfield is a 10-lot subdivision on just under 5 acres in the semi-annual uplands. It's being proposed by Larry Weaver, representing the ownership group, and Craig Parkinson with Cascade Engineering Group. It's located in West Plain. If you zoom in a little bit, I'll take you on a quick tour of the property.
Alex, before you go any further, you said it is the ownership group. Who is the ownership group?
Larry Weaver is the primary owner. Parkinson, would you care to elaborate on that? Andy Investments is the other portion of that.
Who's the primary owner of the investment? Do we know this at this stage of the game?
Hi, I'm Craig Parkinson with Cascade Engineering Group. Dan Sandy and Larry Weaver are partners in Sandy Investments. That's who owns the property.
Okay. Are they local, by any chance? Are they local?
I'm not sure where Dan lives. Larry lives down near Tukwila. They were owners of a large part of Birch Point until a recent sale here a few months ago.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Alex. I just wanted to clarify that.
No problem. My pleasure. Mr. Jones, if you could highlight the... can you go back one slide? If you could just use your cursor to show the golf club there. At the bottom, there's a golf course, golf club there. So you can see the roof of plats just around the corner. And if you, and that's Turnberry Wood right across the street. If you go to the next slide, Looking at an oblique aerial photo, you see that the city actually owns a water tower with a cellular tower located on the upper left-hand corner. You can see the access road going into the property and turning to the left, which is the south, and to get access to that property there. And then there's Goldeneye Lane right across Semyama Parkway. And, of course, that's Whatcom County to the top of the photo, which is the west. And I'll take you on a quick tour of the property here. So that's looking north from the driveway entrance. And right down there, it's really hard to see, but there's the entrance to Turnberry Wood. You can see the multimodal trail as part of the Coast Millennium Trail on the left there. And this is looking into the property. That's the access road to the water tower, to the cellular site. And then you can see most of the property is undeveloped. It's a deciduous forest. There's a lot of ferns. The next slide shows the lot layout there. This is what the preliminary plat is going to look like. You can see there's a large buffer along Semyama Parkway. It's approximately 100 feet wide. And then there's 10 lots. Next slide. You can see that there's a one-way circulation road that will go into a cul-de-sac and come back out. And then this is just a diagram of what the lot layout could potentially look like. And I'm going to point out later that not all the homes there face the cul-de-sac directly. And so that's some of the issues I'll bring up in a couple moments here. And there's a couple flag lots that are accessed off of shared driveways. And the driveway to the bottom of the page going to the south actually will access the city water tower site. So this is just a graphic showing what the homes will look like approximately. Public notification has been completed. Next button. The applicant did a community conference with the neighborhood. They posted, or they mailed out notices to everyone, held a community conference back in October. We did receive three public comments, one from Department of Natural Resources, just talking about some of the wildlife in the vicinity. One from the Semyama Resort Association, and one from the SRA, Semyama Resort Association Architectural Standards Committee. And those are all in your packets. The project has a mitigated determination of non-significance. There are two small regulated wetlands on the site, so the CEPA decision there requires that they comply with the city critical areas ordinance and get an approved mitigation plan before they do any work within the vicinity of the wetlands or before they record the final plat. There's some clearing limits, and then the fire or emergency services mitigation fees are awarded to the fire district. So the Planning Commission reviewed the sections of code that are applicable to the project. Those are listed there. We looked in the comprehensive plan, we went over the goals and policies. The staff report identified that those were all pretty consistent. The one biggest issue probably is in the resort Semyama master plan. The original master plan, or actually the current master plan, breaks Semyama into a bunch of different zones. And the project is located in Zone 12, which is part of the golf course district. And that called for 1 to 2 units per acre of single-family development. So the project is entirely consistent with the original Semyama master plan. However, in 1991, the City Council approved the Cannery Hill PUD and then adopted it as part of the master plan as an appendix. So this is the border of the Cannery Hill PUD. You can see the plat of Mirfield up there in the corner, and most of the Cannery Hill PUD is out in the county. So if we take a look at the site plan for Cannery Hill PUD on the next slide, you can see that there's the black area is just open space buffer. So a lot of this property inside the city is actually just designated open space, part of the golf course, and then this entrance road. If we look at where the project is located, right there, you can see there's one small multi-family neighborhood. So when we take a look at some of the issues with the Cannery Hill PUD, it sets it up that there is 0.7 units per acre of multifamily development on the city portion of that project. However, the county removed that area from the urban growth area, and that portion of the project that is in the county has long since expired. So a similar project couldn't be applied for and approved today. Those land use densities.
Yes. Can I ask
why have we not updated the semiannual master plan to reflect that?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, when we started this process, we pointed that out to our planning commission, and they actually asked staff to prepare an amendment to update the portion of the master plan, at least to look at some of those appendices. Now, the overall master plan does need updating, too.
But my question is, why haven't we done this? This has been known for a long period of time.
Alex is probably not the best person to answer that.
We're leaving this thing where we know that changes are required, and we do nothing. I don't understand why, when we know something has to be done, why we don't do it.
I thought there was a huge cost issue.
We can amend the master plan anytime we want. It's our master plan. And when we notice something is totally out of sync with what should be, we don't do it.
It can certainly be made more of a priority. The city, we work on a lot of different issues, and updating the master plan would be a decision to take us away from something else.
But can't we amend it bit by bit by bit? We don't have to do the whole thing all over again. But when we notice something like is so out of whack, we've got property inside a UGA that's now gone, at that point I think we should have revised it to reflect that.
I appreciate that perspective.
Now we've got a developer coming along, and because we haven't revised it, we've got a developer trying to develop a piece of land which is in a plan that is out of date. It doesn't make sense to me to do it this way.
I understand that, and actually that's why we worked with the Planning Commission to bring forward an amendment for them to initiate. They're going to look at it on Thursday, and it would be to take Cannery Hill and the West Semiahmoo District, which is very similar to this, out of the master plan and just negate them, so that it would revert to the original master plan, which is consistent with this project. It's just, to change it piece by piece is not really something that's ever been considered as a good plan, but this certainly would be a good thing to do to remove these two elements.
It's a logical thing to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's not, something that one normal person wouldn't expect to do.
So we are taking action on that. I think that is the good news. If I continue on here, the Resort Semiahmoo Master Plan does provide flexibility built within it, though. So even though the Cannery Hill PUD does call for multifamily, it's really low density, there's a couple sections that allow single-family development in multifamily districts. You can have increased density as long as you don't exceed the overall number of units for all of Semiahmoo. And per the 2007 milestone report, that's the build-out of Semiahmoo has been reduced by about 1,000 units. So we're not violating any conditions there by increasing the density just a little bit.
Yeah, but who makes that decision?
Which decision, sir?
Who makes that decision to change from a multifamily to single family?
Well, in this case, it would be the city council because it's a planned unit development.
So you're proposing that to us tonight?
We're recommending approval. So that summarized our review of the Semiahmoo Master Plan. We also looked at the non-motorized transportation plan, which does call for an on-street bike lane right across the front of the property. However, Semiahmoo Parkway is already fully developed, and there is a multimodal trail, the Coast Millennium Trail, right there. So we're recommending that the applicant not install that bike lane.
Whoops, say that again, please. I missed that.
So the non-motorized transportation plan calls for an on-street bike lane along Semiahmoo Parkway. And because of the presence of the Coast Millennium Trail, there already is an 8-foot-wide paved trail along the side that can be used by bicycles. And the fact that they would only be building a short little section of it, we're recommending that they not do that in this case. We don't want that bike lane stopping and then starting a couple hundred feet later.
So it would only be a couple hundred feet of bike lane on the whole of Semiahmoo Parkway, which in the long run, a bike lane on Semiahmoo Parkway in addition to the trail is called for and would be a good thing, but to just have a couple hundred feet of it now doesn't really make sense from an engineering perspective or a safety perspective. So we're proposing they not do that.
I'm sorry, I missed something. Are you talking about just creating a bike lane right there and not on the rest of the parkway? I mean,
just the office.
Yeah, they would. This would call for the creation of a bike lane along Semiahmoo Parkway, and there already is a bicycle facility in sense.
From where to where?
Well, the non-motorized transportation plan calls along the entire parkway from the spit all the way out to Lincoln Road, I believe.
But I think what you're asking about is what we're saying is don't do that as part of this project because a couple hundred feet of bike lane doesn't make sense.
Yes. No.
5 miles of it or 3 miles of it absolutely does, and someday it'll be there. But just a little piece today is not appropriate.
And there already is the Coast Millennium Trail, which is open to bicycles. So next slide. That basically concludes our comprehensive plan. This, the Planning Commission is recommending the project is consistent with the comprehensive plan.
One question, if I may, Alex.
Yes.
When this master plan was approved, did Trillian own all of the land fell into the master plan?
I'm not sure about that. I think they owned the majority, but I'm not sure if they owned all of it.
In the Cannery Hill master plan?
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't absolutely know for sure, but they had participation with all of the property owners that are included in the master plan, because those properties that weren't included were exceptions, and if you look back at the map, you can see the properties that were cut out and left out of the master plan because they weren't master planning someone else's property.
Okay, so what's happened is pieces of that land have been sold off individually, and yet the master plan that was associated with them all as a group has gone along with the pieces as they've been sold off.
That's right, and the sale of those properties was not your typical sale. What happened was they reverted to investors when they were foreclosed on. So it wasn't, and I don't know the case of this particular property, but it wasn't that Trillium went out and sold pieces to people. They had investors who had underwritten and used, they had used those properties as collateral, and so in their financial difficulties, all of the property in the city of Blaine, except for one piece that was owned by Trillium, has become owned by other people.
And the master plan, although it may have been developed largely by Trillium, was in fact adopted by the city, so it became a city master plan, not a Trillium master plan.
That's right.
So that whatever the city master plan says now is what applies to these guys and any other folks.
That's right.
Thank you.
So let's take a look at the criteria for a planned unit development permit. So the first one actually is superior design, and there's a couple little issues that came up during the review. And there, lots 4 and 8 are flag lots. Lot 7 actually has 22 feet of frontage. That was corrected by the applicant. Thank you, Mr. Parkinson. And the building footprint of lot 9 is set back. So not all the streets, remember I pointed that at the beginning, or not all the lots face the street exactly, and some of them are set back. That was just a couple minor little things that we wanted to point out there. The rest of the criteria have all been met.
What's a flag lot?
So if you could go back one slide. A flag lot, if you look at lot 8 down there in the corner, there's like a long little stem or a long road that basically defines a flag lot. So there's not a lot of street frontage. There's like a long driveway to a lot in the back, essentially. So there's also a special criteria for residential PUDs. And one of the biggest ones is that they provide usable open space, and that they dedicate basically 15% of their entire property area, exclusive of critical areas and buffers, for usable open space. Do you have questions for
I do. I noticed in the proposal that to meet this 15% space, they are proposing to include the golf courses.
Yes.
Okay, that is correct.
They actually made an argument that we accepted that because the original PUD did include the golf courses, and there's actually closer to 22% of all of the entire Semiahmoo development, that they're already meeting that usable open space requirement.
What?
Because in the original Semiahmoo PUD, they had 165 acres set aside for recreational purposes, such as the golf course, that they already met this requirement through the original Semiahmoo PUD, which set aside 22% of the entire land already.
And they are within the boundaries.
And they are within the boundaries of that original Semiahmoo PUD.
But let's look at it in a slightly different fashion. The word that you have there is usable. And yet, I, as a resident of the Semiahmoo and a member of the Semiahmoo Resort Association, am not entitled to use those golf courses. It is not usable to all of the residents there.
Absolutely.
It is usable only to those who are members of the golf course as well. So the spirit, at least, of usable is certainly not met.
And that's you cannot, you're not supposed to use the trails, you're not supposed to play on it, you can't go back. Kids, everybody's forbidden to be on the golf course except golf club members and their direct guests. So that's kind of out the window.
Well, Alex, in the original Semiahmoo master plan, my understanding is there is no section with definitions. Is that correct?
Could you restate that question?
I say there is no section in the Semiahmoo master plan that has definitions of various items.
I'd want to double check that. You may be right.
For example, when we looked at seagrass, there was no definition of cottages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, is there a definition in the Semiahmoo master plan on open space?
Yes, or not in the Semiahmoo master plan. I'm not sure about that. But these are the residential PUD standards under the Blaine Municipal Code.
Okay. Now, which takes precedent, the Semiahmoo master plan or our PUD?
Well, they both apply.
How can they both apply? Because there is no definition. You're applying a Blaine open space PUD definition as opposed to a Semiahmoo PUD definition.
Well, I think you can do that. I think they both apply.
In other words, if we ignored the Blaine PUD standards,
mm-hmm,
what would the definition for open space be under the Semiahmoo master plan?
Well, Mr. Mayor, we can figure that out, and we can spend time making a decision on what that would be. But the fact here is that what we're trying to determine is, does it comply with the Blaine Municipal Code PUD standards? And so when we're trying to determine if it complies with the PUD standards.
Don't you have to also see that it applies to the Semiahmoo master plan?
We do, but the Semiahmoo master plan doesn't have a component that says do this much open space and are you doing it. So we looked at the master plan and we evaluated that it was generally compliant with the master plan with the exception of the Cannery Hill overlay, and that if you withdrew that from your consideration, it is consistent with the master plan. So then we went to the next step, which is to determine compliance with the municipal code. And in the municipal code, there's a definition for open space. That's the one we're using when we're doing code
compliance.
Now, did
we do the same thing to all the other developments within Semiahmoo? Did we use the Blaine PUD for open space for all the other projects that have been done within Semiahmoo?
I don't know. It's been going on for 30 years. I don't know the answer to that question.
But we're applying it to this project without knowing whether it was applied to other projects.
We apply the code that's in place at the time that the project is vested to the project as we review it, because to do the code from 25 or 30 years ago and the one that was used on Boundary Ridge or some other project would be illegal. So, yeah, we're using the code in place at the time that this project was proposed. That's what we have to do. That's the law, because it's vested to that.
Quick question. If I understood what you just said correctly, you are applying the Blaine standards, saying that at least 15% of the total site area must be usable. It's the Blaine standard,
That's correct.
It's the municipal code standard, yes.
Okay, and presumably the municipal code standard does have such a definition of what the 15% must comprise.
It does.
Okay, and does the standard include golf courses which are not accessible to many of the residents?
It's probably not that specific, and I don't know it off the top of my head. What I can say is that the Planning Commission, in their consideration, determined that it met this standard.
Fair enough.
And that's the recommendation that we're bringing.
And I understand that it is a recommendation, but it is a recommendation.
Right.
And what I'm saying is that to call a golf course that many people have no access to as usable land is not a reasonable and plausible definition of usable land. So although the Planning Commission did, in fact, recommend that I agree with that, I find myself unable to do so.
So let me, before we move off this point, or maybe to help us move off this point and onto the others, I do want to point out that there is open space in this project.
Great.
There's a substantial amount of open space in this project. They just, in order to achieve the get up to the 15%, they also looked and said, well, you know, they need a little bit more open space to meet this standard, and there's 22% open space in the project, most of which is in the golf course, but some of it is in other parcels. They didn't substitute the golf course for all the open space. They just said, okay, we're not quite where we probably should be. Here are some of the other factors, and that is that overall in Semiahmoo, 22% was set aside, which is not all entirely the golf course, but it substantially is.
All of these are very relevant comments. However, I say again that a reasonable person would say that a development should stand on the 15% requirement in and of itself, not by saying, well, there's a park down the road or there's a this over there that we're going to count because they're close. The development has to stand in and of itself.
It is part of the master plan, of course, but if I could point out real quickly that when we were looking at that 15%, there is that 100-foot buffer right along the Semiahmoo Parkway, and so there is public access, of course, along the trail because that's in the public right-of-way, and so they're setting aside that 100-foot buffer area, and when we did some math on that, that actually worked out to about 15%, and so with that area, we made an argument that area actually could enhance your the aesthetic views, you know, walking down the trail by preserving a forested section along the trail.
Agreed. And does the developer own that strip?
Yes.
Okay, then the developer can make the case with the land that he owns that the 15% requirement is met, yes?
The 15% is, but it's not quite the usable open space because it's that they're not exactly allowing the public to just meander through their woods. There isn't like a public access easement over it. They are building a little community gathering area. It's basically a couple tables or a picnic table and a couple benches that has yet to be determined. They'll flush that out. They have a little meeting area right there on the edge of their road.
On the trail, sort of as like a trail rest stop.
A public amenity.
But the Blaine City Code, as I understand it, told me, says that if you want to approve a PUD, there must be 15% water open space in the piece of land that you're bringing to us today.
If you use the definition usable the way you're defining it, I can't come over to and use your property and open space.
Sure.
You fence me out.
You can use
it. It's not usable.
You can use the trail, you can use the park, you can use the whatever.
I use some of it.
And
but I can't use, it's not, it's,
you can't
it's
use
not
the golf
open
course
to me or anybody else in the community to go do it. The idea of usable is a definition that everyone can use it.
Yeah. So under that, you have to take all the golf course out.
Whatever. But you have to take your fences down, too.
There are no fences around the golf course.
How come everybody's trying not to make this work? We're looking for, to me, I'm trying to figure out how come you guys from Semiahmoo are trying to make this not work. I have a little bit of problem with that.
Can I get a clarification? Charlie, could you repeat that Clark could hear in the microphone?
I have a hard time. The most opposition from this is coming from you guys from Semiahmoo who are inside the gates that I can't go inside the gates. You live in a different world than I do. Curious why you guys are so
okay.
Yes, I mean, honestly.
Let me answer at least for me.
in the sense that I ask that the same standards be applied to a development there as would be applied to development here. If somebody were to propose a 10-unit or 10-acre PUD in Coeur d'Alene, and if we were to require 15% of the total site area be usable open space for them here in Blaine, I suggest that those same regulations ought to apply to something that's in West Blaine.
Were those same regulations, I mean, it's like we're trying to have one separate here, so, but you guys, when you put in semi-annual, we're using a different.
We're not. That's what we're saying. If you want to apply the Blaine PUD to a development in West Semiahmoo or West Blaine, then you have to apply play by the same rules. You can't have two different rules, one for Semiahmoo and one for here, if you're going to use your residential PUD standards. You have to provide 15% of the total site area as open space. You can't, and Gary's just said, you can't. We won't allow him to walk on our golf course. We're not going to let any of the residents of Muirfield walk on our golf course.
Councilmen, or council members.
But I'm saying you won't allow me to walk anywhere.
In your neighborhood.
Not true.
Past the gates.
We have tourists, we have people walking there every day, we have them riding bicycles, we have them come around buzzing around in there all the time. There are gates around the gates where the cars go. There's gates everywhere. It is totally open. And everybody's welcome to walk anywhere they want to in Semiahmoo. There is one sign that prevents that.
That's not my except
on the golf. Okay, Dennis, I'll get you.
Okay. I've always had to punch a code or call somebody who lives there to let me in.
Paul, I think we have made our concern manifest. Perhaps we can say, please go to the developer and ask if they can meet the same regulations that would be applied were they doing something in the center of Blaine.
Dennis has a question.
Why
are we talking about two PUDs?
Well, I think Semiahmoo is a little different. They have their, they have the Semiahmoo master plan out there. Essentially, any development out there is part of that project where they already dedicated a bunch of open space.
But weren't those areas that were developed also a PUD?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what you're asking, these folks are asking is, here's our PUD, and we're going to use the situation, whatever the rules are now in the city of Blaine, and we apply those. Now, does it make any difference if they belong to the Semiahmoo Resort community or not? If they were a member of that community, would it make a difference?
I don't believe that it would make a difference to this particular standard.
So we should just be talking about the PUD for the applicant, not whatever it has to do with the PUD that was established however many years ago for Semiahmoo.
Well, one slight discrepancy there maybe is that the Semiahmoo Resort Semiahmoo Master Plan applies to the entire area, whether they join the SRA or not. That's why we did an extensive review on it.
Alex, isn't it a PUD?
Yes. Yes.
Then why do we have two PUDs for Semiahmoo? Why do we not ignore the Blaine PUD and just apply the Semiahmoo PUD?
I disagree with that.
Why two PUDs? I mean, you're saying here, well, we're going to ignore the Semiahmoo PUD and we're not going to apply the Blaine PUD.
Let me get that. Alex, we're not saying we're going to ignore one. We're applying the aspects of the Resort Semiahmoo PUD that was approved and covered the whole area to the project through review of the master plan. And
why do we need this PUD?
Because our code is designed to approve PUDs as an aspect of the municipal code. We've always done that. It's a conceptual overlay for those properties that were not platted. So when somebody came in to do Drayton Hillside, when someone came in to do Drayton Hillside 2, when someone came in to do Troon, when someone came in to do
the Airy and Seagrass 2 and every one of those, they went through a PUD process. That's how it was done. There's an overlying PUD for the entire area that set aside a certain amount, that set up a certain structure and rules, which are reflected in the Resort Semiahmoo Master Plan. And only those properties that weren't divided and created as lots in that very first step, every one of those has been platted through a PUD since then. So this is the normal process. There's the overarching Semiahmoo PUD, and then there are PUDs within it that set the standards. And the PUDs within it are regulated under the Blaine Municipal Code and the guidelines of the Resort Semiahmoo Master Plan.
So every one of those projects, other than the first ones that were platted, have got 15% open space?
No, almost definitely not, because this regulation...
But that's our PUD.
That's right, sir. And this regulation was adopted about 2 years ago, so virtually none of those projects were held to the standard. In fact, I think none of those projects were held to the standard.
Okay, so we now got a new standard which we have to apply to this Muirfield development.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And the Planning Commission determined that, because it was part of the Resort Semiahmoo Master Plan, that obligation has been fulfilled. And that's really all I can present to you at this time.
Well, so here's the thing.
How do you...
Councilman Greeno brought up a point, which was he thinks there's direction that hasn't been met. That has yet to be determined. What we need to do is finish the presentation.
Yep.
If you have an issue as a majority on an item that you feel has not been satisfied, you should remand this back to the Planning Commission with direction on what you want reviewed or amended or changed. We have a recommendation that says they believe, given the larger picture, this is resolved, and it can be approved because there's a large area of open space set aside in the greater PUD, and virtually the entire 15% is set aside. It's just not entirely usable. They could make it usable by cutting down all the trees, but we didn't think that was the best option for the open space adjacent to the highway, the parkway. So what we need to do is agree that you're not satisfied with this, or at least some of you are not satisfied with this, and finish the presentation so that you can make a decision one way or another on what to do.
Fair enough. So I did want to point out that one issue about the open space. Next slide, please.
I didn't hear you.
Just moving along, they have a couple options. They can either join, so the PUD code requires that they have a homeowners association with CC&R. So they can either join the Semiahmoo Resort Association, or they can create their own homeowners association and own set of CC&Rs. So they have the option to do that. There's a whole section on private streets. Typically, a street has to be public, and so if they want to make it a private street, they have to meet these criteria. And there's a couple I want to point out here. Number 5, that the comprehensive plan does not identify any through access extending across the site. In this case, it does. But it's through the Cannery Hill PUD, and we've already talked about some of the issues with that. So the other one is that the applicants demonstrate the ability to maintain a private street system. And they haven't done that yet, but they've stated that they intend to join the SRA. And if they do that, the SRA has a private street maintenance program that would satisfy that requirement. And if they don't join the SRA, they can come up with their own maintenance program.
Okay, question, if I may. I'll try to make it a quick one. Why would the SRA want to let them in? It isn't as though they can come knocking on the door of the SRA and say, we want to be members, you're going to take us. Because, as you pointed out, if they don't join the SRA, they're responsible for coming up with their own street maintenance plan. By concept, then, if they do join the SRA is in turn responsible for maintaining their streets.
That's correct.
And from what I've heard from some of my constituents, that's not an exciting possibility.
Well, I believe they can work that out with the SRA when they petition them to join. Of course, they'd be paying their dues. And
fair
so
enough.
Forth.
That's the short
dues
answer.
And a latecomer's fee or whatever the corresponding thing might be. But rather than say that the applicant will join the SRA, I might be more comfortable with the applicant will either join the SRA or and make the provision.
That is indeed the case. They have to do that. And if, as this next slide points out, they actually have 180 days to do that. They need to come back with a final PUD master plan, And actually, that gets approved by Planning Commission. So they have to come back to the city and say, here's how we're going to do everything. We're either joining the SRA or we're not. If we're not doing it, here's some of these extra things. So once they, if they did get approved, they'd have that entitlement to, move forward and kind of come up with the final plan. Next slide, please.
Clark's got a question.
Yes.
Yeah. I have one simple question, and it's curiosity more than anything else. If they join the SRA, do they intend to comply with the ASC standard?
Yes, I believe that would be required.
We don't know what they intend, honestly, I guess is one answer to that. But if you join the SRA, you're subject to all the SRA rules and regulations and the covenants. So you wouldn't join it if you didn't want to play by the rules. That would be silly.
Alternatively, the SRA might refuse admission if you didn't agree to play by the rules.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And that's why we can't make them join SRA. Right.
No, I don't want you to.
Thank you.
So moving right along, that was basically the plan unit development requirements of our code, but another applicable section is the subdivision design standards. However, as I mentioned before, Semiahmoo Parkway is already fully developed, so a lot of those sections don't apply, but a couple of the few ones that do are street lighting, so they'll need to do a little lighting at the intersection, some pedestrian lighting, and street trees. We're actually recommending this requirement be waived by the city council. They not do street trees because of the forested nature of Semiahmoo. We didn't want them installing a bunch of deciduous trees at even intervals down one side of the parkway for a couple hundred feet. So, neighborhood pattern for subdivisions, a couple items there. It's not a typical block and grid pattern. There's no trail access off the end of the cul-de-sac because, well, there's nowhere for it to go. And this last one here that actually requires street stubs to be connected to adjacent properties if there's development capacity of four or more units. In this case, we're recommending that not be applied because Semiahmoo Parkway has, the neighboring properties have a huge frontage along Semiahmoo Parkway. Those properties, if you recall, are kind of long and skinny, and so there's plenty of access. And in addition to that, providing a new street, north-south street, right next to the parkway would create substandard block length, so that would create some traffic issues. So we're recommending that not be applied in this case. Just a couple of the items that some of the lots didn't have the preferred orientation, or flag lots are discouraged, they're not prohibited. Moving along here. But I did want to point out that the project will be designed to the 2012 Department of Ecology Stormwater Manual. So that's one of the first projects we'll see to come meet that higher standard for stormwater, and they are doing infiltration on the site, so it's not a conventional stormwater system. They plan to, put all the water into the ground. So that's basically summarizes that. There is finding number six, which talks about some of those discrepancies, but overall the Planning Commission determined that the project did meet the subdivision design standards. Preliminary plat standards basically calls for the council to make several findings that have to do with promoting orderly development, and the commission reviewed those for you, and those are listed up there. Under the residential plan recreation zone, basically refers back to the Resort Semiahmoo Master Plan. It said, the Resort Semiahmoo Master Plan essentially wrote new zoning standards for that whole area through the PUD process that they already did one time. I have spoken with the applicant. He's on board. He agrees with all these conditions and the findings. There was one minor revision. It seems quite a little bit minor right now, but that they wanted to change finding of fact 11 to say that the applicant has stated that it is their intent to join the Semiahmoo Resort Association instead of that they will do it. So just a little minor change there, and the staff is recommends that be made. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Staff is recommending approval based on the findings of fact and conditions of approval attached to Ordinance 13-28-29.
I would suggest that we send it back for definition.
I'd like to ask Alex a question. Alex, the new rules, the 212, have you got the diagram for the stormwater arrangement?
I don't have it. I think it may, and we could probably pull it up, but essentially everything drains in the center of the cul-de-sac, And there will be basically a big rain garden infiltration system right there. So the street will drain to the center, and then there's a big circle. You could probably click on that one right above it, or right there. So that gray area or brown area right there in the center, that will be the infiltration area.
So all of the stormwater from the roofs and the roads are going to go into that rain garden arrangement?
Actually, just the street and the driveways will be going into the center, and each home will have a spreader installed. There will be the final stormwater report will have options for different sizes of the houses to actually have infiltration basically right there on private property in their yard. They'll have a little stormwater spreader. The sand, the soil out there is really sandy, so it should work well.
And the slope is in which general direction?
Boy, that's a good question. I'm not sure I have an answer for that. It's pretty flat.
Yeah. It's a little undulating, but it's actually pretty dark flat.
It doesn't slope west towards the...
Away for outside the city limits?
No.
Probably some of it, it might. It is really very flat. You could probably pour water on four different spots and have it go in four different directions.
Okay.
But it's very low, separate. Small.
Then it'd go into the ground.
It would probably soak in because it's mostly very sandy and gravelly.
Where does that water that infiltrates, if it gets into the ground that easily, where does it end up?
Don't know the answer to that for sure. It ends up in the upper levels of groundwater. That's what it does today when it rains. The water soaks in. From a little bit of information that I do know, I don't know where this exact water goes, but a lot of the water, what it does do in that area when it falls is rainwater, it infiltrates, which is what's been happening for thousands of years there, is it comes out in springs in the bluffs.
Okay. I think that's towards Birch Bay in that area. There's
probably
drains out that way.
So it is. There is a hard pan arrangement?
In some areas there is.
Okay.
Eventually, down low. But bear in mind, this isn't new water. This is the water that falls on that site, just like it is, you know.
But it's not as if you had a steep slope that you're worrying about.
No, no. It's very flat.
One question, definitional question. The city of Blaine has evidently a working definition for open or usable spaces, such as we've been talking about. Would the trade area along the parkway be considered a usable area if the trees were left standing as they are?
Let me pull up the definition.
Tip for a flat belly, I'm looking for that.
The reason I ask, of course, is that my instinct says that ought to be considered a usable area, even though you can't play frisbee on it. Yeah, it's a trail, it's owned in common. You can enjoy it by looking at it, if not by anything else.
Right.
And Commissioner Greeno, I think that's kind of what our planning commission arrived at, too. I mean, they kind of considered everything. They didn't say just this project or just the golf course.
The reason I ask is because it's been suggested that if we don't count the golf course, what the applicant's going to do is to cut all those trees along the parkway. And I think that's a false dichotomy. I think that those trees along the parkway, as the planning commission suggested, do constitute a usable area, and hence it should be counted in the 15%. My suspicion is that you're real close to the 15%. You ain't there, but you're real close to it.
Well, they have the 15%. That front 100 feet actually constitutes 15%, and I believe there's 30% of the entire property already going to be dedicated as passive.
Okay, then I become very happy very quickly if you say that the property, with counting the land that the developer owns, meets the 15% requirement.
Yeah.
And then my issue goes away. My issue arises when you try to count the golf course as part of it.
Who said that? Did you say that you were counting the golf course as part of the 15%?
Yeah. Well, we didn't. That's right.
Okay, well, maybe it wasn't right to say that then. Because when I look at this picture, just visual, and I look at the polka dot area, which is open space, that looks about... visually, 15%.
Yeah, it's even more than that. Just that section next to the road,
just
that
next
right
to the
there.
Road.
That's that. Not even counting the actual cul-de-sac, just the two ends of that, or 15%.
So why was the golf course even mentioned?
Well, because that's not doesn't meet the definition of usable open space. There's no
public. This doesn't?
That's right. There's no public access easement over it. Mr. John, do you?
It doesn't have a trail network in it.
I guess the question is, Alec, if you leave out the golf course, mm-hmm. how much space is it of the 15%? You don't include the golf course. How much open space is there? What percentage?
15%.
No, but the definition 15%. Of open space says
15%. It's right at about 15%.
But it doesn't meet our definition.
Okay. Because it doesn't have a trail system throughout it. It wasn't really envisioned that a forested area would be considered usable open space when it stood in basically its natural condition. That really is the crux of the issue.
Okay, then why don't we try this? Why don't we ask the Planning Commission to revisit the area, remove the reference to the golf course, because that's offensive, and if it requires a jiggering of the definition of usable area to include the treed area, even though there's not a network of trails through it, to include some of the other area, even though there's not an amenity land, I think we'll be happy.
I understand that, sir, and you'll need to get two of your fellow council members to agree with that position, not me.
Okay, fair enough. The easiest possible way for me to do that, to attempt that at least, is to say, I move we remand this to the Planning Commission for clarification on meeting the usable area criteria. Do I have a second?
I do.
Okay. Any comments, observations? Okay, let's call for the vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Now, I have another question. Somewhere out there, the cannery, whatever it's called, is a PUD. And it still exists?
No.
No.
Well,
it's expired.
No, wait a second.
That's actually yes and no. The
yes
the
and no, because there are, this is one parcel of some PUD that existed that is in the city of Blaine.
And the only reason why it's still, we're even talking about that, is because the council adopted it as an appendices to the resort semi-annual master plan.
So does it exist then? Is it still in existence?
The Cannery Hill PUD?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's part of the master plan, semi-annual master plan.
Okay. Now, how much verbiage is in that PUD? In other words, what does it say? It's in the master plan, the appendix. How big is it? Is it 10 pages? One paragraph? How big is it? What does it say?
It's a few pages. It's mostly maps and illustrations and development. It was a development proposal similar to this.
Now, does any of that apply to this project that we're reviewing?
The recommendation from the Planning Commission is, while it all applies, because the Cannery Hill PUD is, they could not conceive of it being built under the current regulations and the current city limits and the current UGA. It was, although it applies, not relevant to this decision, and it should be considered to not apply effectively.
Well, in addition to that, the portion of the county's expired, and they wouldn't be allowed to even apply for that again.
But that doesn't apply to the stuff that is in the city of Blaine, does it?
That's right. And the 10% of the Cannery Hill PUD that was in the city of Blaine is like a big driveway into this multifamily development out in the county.
So would it be fair to say that the original PUD applies except when it doesn't?
I think that's true.
Yeah. You could say that.
Can you get rid of it?
And we're working on that, yes. Yeah. On Thursday.
So you have to remove that.
Just remove it from the...
On Thursday, we're bringing to the Planning Commission a application for them to review and to determine whether the commission or the chair should sign to initiate it as a comprehensive plan amendment to remove it from the Resort Semiyamu Master Plan. Because it's essentially at this point ludicrous. It would require that we build one hole of an 18-hole golf course inside the city. Not the other 17 holes. Those will not get built, but one hole. It just makes no sense at all. So they're saying, get rid of it. We said, good idea. We'll bring you an application. You can initiate it. And it will come to you on the docket in January of this next year for you to move it forward. It's not a quick and easy thing.
Michael, but if we remove it, that leaves that little strip without a PUD.
No, no, it doesn't. It will revert to the original approval of the resort Semiahmoo Master Plan, what was originally proposed before it was amended in 1991.
Okay, so it goes back and reverts back to whatever.
Yeah.
What was that under the original
plan? Well, that area is actually called the Golf Course District, and that's Zone 12, and that's one of the
single-family
homes. I think they said, well, this is part of the Golf Course District, and they already set aside, 165 acres.
But that doesn't make sense.
And they said to us when they came in for the pre-application, what do we do? And we said, the best thing for you to do is design to the original master plan, because the Cannery Hill master PUD can only be considered to be non-relevant since it is about 85-90% outside the city limits, outside the UGA. It includes a golf course that won't be built. It includes homes that won't be built. And really, all you own is an entrance road. But that doesn't make any sense because it's an entrance to nothing.
What about the property to the north and south?
It is designed for single-family homes at one to two dwelling units per acre, basically just what we've showed you tonight.
And that's north and south of where Muirfield is?
Mostly just north. To the south, it's a different story because the boundary changes and things, but mostly okay, just north.
But north of it, it's going to fall under single-family homes?
Single-family homes in the golf course district, and you'll probably see people come in with proposals very much like this.
Now, how do we make up this multifamily thing if we all go single-family homes? Where are we going to put the multifamily things that are required under the master plan?
They're not required under the master plan. The master plan has allowances for building single-family in those areas where multifamily was initially proposed.
So there is no requirement for us in Semiahmoo, for Semiahmoo Master Plan to build multifamily housing?
There is not a de facto requirement, no. I mean, there will always be an exception to that rule, because someday I'll probably be standing here telling you, well, you need to, this has to be multifamily, but that may be resulting in some other set of circumstances.
Yeah, but there's no other factors involved with the city of Blaine that would require us over in Semiahmoo to have multifamily housing.
Required? No.
Michael?
It's allowed, yes, and we don't have minimum density requirements,
okay. Which
maybe we should, but that's a separate issue.
Okay.
How would this affect the growth management in terms of the density requirements for the city of Blaine?
That was kind of what I was just saying, that we don't have minimum density standards, and that's a different discussion. Maybe we should. It is very, very subtly and through a long and convoluted analysis of whether we're meeting our requirements to fill, to accommodate the population, I mean. And it's one project's not going to make a difference. Someday, a long time down the road, someone may say, you're not achieving enough density. You need to start trying to figure out where more homes are going to go. But at this point, GMA doesn't say that. We're supposed to work towards achieving four dwelling units per acre, but there is no hard and fast rule.
Thank you, Council.
Okay,
so it's remanded to the Planning Commission to evaluate the open space issue.
Okay. Next item on the agenda is Ordinance 13-2828, Title 17.42, Planned Residential District Zone Text Amendment regarding optional planned unit development permit.
So this is simple in comparison.
No.
But then again, I thought the other one was. This is a code amendment to make PUDs optional on 5-acre lots or those lots which are smaller than 5 acres in the planned residential zone. The planned residential zone is primarily East Blaine, is what you think of it as. It essentially starts at Lincoln Park and goes to the east. So that's the zone we're talking about. Ironically, it would maybe almost make sense if we were talking about the RPR zone, where that project was. That project actually brings to light a really relevant point. That project's about 5 acres, the one that we were just talking about. And what we're talking about here is requiring projects that are 5 acres and smaller to go through a PUD leads to substantial challenges and great additional expense and delay of the project, in our opinions. And so staff recommended that projects in this area of East Plain not have to go through a PUD, but that it be optional. The current regulations are that all development requires a PUD. It adds expense, complication, and time. It makes a better product in the long run for large developments. I 100% stand behind it. It makes a better product in the long run for large developments. But small developments, it's very difficult. So what we would do is we would propose, what has been proposed by the Planning Commission is that for a new development of over 5 acres, it would still require a PUD. New development, smaller, 5 acres or smaller, in that zone, a PUD would be optional. They'd still have a review process. They'd still have to go through a plat or a short plat or whatever other permit applied, but the PUD would be optional. So it doesn't remove the flexibility that a PUD offers people, because you can still do it if you want to, but it does avoid the unnecessary or the extra difficulty and levels of review that are required of a PUD. So what properties are we talking about? If you look at the image up there, there are quite a few 5 acre and smaller parcels in the East Plain area in the planned residential zoning district. A lot of them are already developed. So this already developed with single family homes. So this is a bit misleading, but most of those that are larger than 10 or 12 or 14,000 square feet, if they're half an acre or larger, there's a good chance they may subdivide at some time in the future. So what you can envision is this. You own an acre. You have one house on it. You want to subdivide it into three lots that are a third of an acre each. You have to do a PUD, and you have to set up a homeowners association, and you have to write CC&Rs, and you have to set aside 15% open space, and you have to do all these other things because you're in the planned residential zoning district. That doesn't make sense. So that's why this has come forward. This is a legislative action. It was initiated by staff. It has been through all the regular process. It's been recommended by the Planning Commission for approval. There has been a public hearing, and a SEPA determination of non-significance was issued. There were no comments on the SEPA. There were no comments at the public hearing other than staff's testimony. Staff recommends approval of Ordinance 13-2828, which would implement the Commission's recommended zoning text changes as supported by their recommended findings of fact that are included in that ordinance.
Michael, are there any situations where you had less than 5 acres where you would think it would be better that a PUD be put in place?
In my opinion, there probably are places where it would be better to do a PUD. But
how do you sell that?
How do I sell that idea to someone? In the initial consultations at the counter, in our initial meetings with them, and through a pre-application process, we'd explain what we think are the advantages and why they should go that way, and here are the things, here are the pros and cons, and we do that on pretty much on a regular basis, but it wouldn't be forced upon someone.
And you say the expense is greater.
The expense is greater because it requires a lot more engineering time, and you also need to bring in an architect and an attorney to write up CC&Rs and those kinds of things, the professional services that you need to put together that application and plan and process it are substantially greater than if all you're doing is hiring an engineer or a surveyor to lay out a short plat or a preliminary plat.
But the advantage is that you get a product that you think would be more suitable.
The advantage of
going through the PUD.
The advantage of going through the PUD would depend upon the property. You said, did I envision that it could be better on some 5 acre smaller parcels? And yeah, it probably could be better because it would let people do smaller lot sizes, and maybe if they had a bunch of wetlands or a really oddly shaped parcel, to say, you know what, we're going to do a PUD because it lets us make our lots different than the regular rules, that would be a situation where it might make sense.
But would that make sense then that those people should maybe be able to do that without going through the expense of a regular PUD?
It should probably make sense that they should be able to do that, but we don't have a mechanism that allows them to do that except for a plat variance, which would be something that some people might take advantage of.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that maybe we're losing out if we don't make it available in some form and not put it at a price.
The PUD would be available. The regular platting process would still be available, and they could still apply for a plat variance, and they could use the criteria in there that basically demonstrate that this is a better design given the property they have to work with.
So there are some options.
There are some options, yeah.
You want to help?
So that, as Dennis has pointed out, this may not be an optimal solution, but it's a step in the right direction. Is that a fair characterization?
I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. The optimal solution might be a code written for each individual property. That's, yeah. This is definitely a step in the right direction.
I'm asking if we move in the right direction. Okay, with that in mind, I move approval.
Second. Okay, now, questions? Bonnie has a question.
What's the maximum number of units that could be developed on a 5-acre parcel?
Without a PUD? So on a 5-acre parcel, typically you're going to lose 1 acre to infrastructure needs, so it's going to drop from 5 acres to 4 acres right off the top.
Okay.
25% or 20% typically is the minimum you would lose. Okay. So you would have 4 acres left in that zone. You'd have 16 units potentially, assuming it was flat, rectangular, and had no wetlands.
Okay. 16 units.
So basically a relatively small neighborhood, no PUD, bigger, 20, 25 lots or more, it's going to shift into the PUD zone, the PUD land.
Right.
Okay, any other questions, comments? Call for the vote. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Now, my understanding is we're going to go into executive session. Is that correct, Sherry?
Yes. Do you know about how many minutes?
No.
18. 20 minutes. Or somewhere between 20 minutes and 2 hours.
Are you guys eating supper?
and no action will be taken, correct?
No action.
Okay, so we're going to break for executive session. We anticipate somewhere between 20 minutes and 2 hours, and we will come back to our regular meeting. We do not have planned to take any action. Okay. Thank you.
He's not serious about that 2 hours.